This week we'll be studying Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 1 through chapter 3, verse 15. Last week, Solomon introduced his topic, the meaninglessness of life, and this week he follows that by attempting to try various methods of giving life meaning. He tries pleasuring himself. He tries accomplishing great things. He seeks out great wisdom, and he focuses himself on his work. But in the end, he finds that his solutions are still just more vanity. In response to this, Solomon begins to advocate a partial solution to the problem. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. In the midst of this solution, Solomon gives us one of the more famous poetic passages of the Bible, describing how there is a time for everything, and especially opposite things, in life. In our application, we will recognize that while Solomon's solution leads us in the direction of attempting to enjoy life through pleasuring ourselves in moderation, moderation is certainly key in this. But we will also recognize that worldly things ultimately cannot satisfy. Ultimate satisfaction is only to be found in eternal reward. Your passage then is Ecclesiastes 2:1 through 3:15, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. In the opening of the passage, Solomon tests himself with pleasure to see if it will satisfy, but he found worldly pleasures to be vanity. So how did he seek to pleasure himself? In verse 3, he tells us that he drank wine, apparently in moderation, not so much that he was drunk and thus without possession of his wisdom. He supposed that having a little wine would make him merry, and then he spent some of his massive fortune building great works which he could enjoy: houses, vineyards, orchards, gardens, parks, and pools of water to irrigate them. Having given himself the ideal setting, he populated that setting with servants to fulfill his every pleasure. He had slaves catering to his every whim, singers to entertain him, and a harem that was second to none. Solomon grew in wealth, measured here in silver and gold and livestock, such as there had never been before. So Solomon had it all. He had enough wealth to get anything that he wanted. He had the ideal living space and servants to do for him anything he wanted, including giving him more sex than anyone could possibly need. He had plenty of good food and wine to drink. He had everything, and he says in verse 10 that there was nothing he wanted that he did not get, and yet he still found it all to be meaningless. I have no doubt that endless pleasure is better than endless pain. But in the end, pleasure doesn't offer abiding satisfaction. Mankind is primed to always want just a little more. Whatever we get, eventually we get bored with it and we want something else. In the end, it is just meaningless, and it still ends in death. In death, all the pleasure dissipates, such that none of it mattered. And all of Solomon's effort to procure pleasure was just part of the endless cycle of human lives under the sun. Others would seek such pleasures, but there would be nothing for them to do that he hadn't already done. They would rise and fall just as he had risen and would fall. Solomon's accomplishments would not last, and neither would those to come after him. All of it pointless. Up next, starting in verse 12, Solomon began to contemplate wisdom. We know he was a wise man. Perhaps by increasing himself in wisdom and learning, Solomon could rise above his circumstances. Maybe he could find a way to make life meaningful, or maybe he could find meaning in knowledge itself. But this didn't satisfy Solomon either. Just as it is better to have pleasure than to not have it, so it is better to have wisdom than to not have it. Having wisdom, after all, is a means to achieving more pleasure. The wise man can see the best way to accomplish the best goals, but the fool doesn't. Regardless, they're all still going to eventually die. So Solomon asked, what really is the point of being wise? One might have the best goals and the best plan for going about those goals and might always do the right things. And doing the right things will bring pleasure for a while. But eventually, the wise and the fool will die just the same. Short of some eternal perspective, all the benefits of wisdom will come to nothing. Solomon also found wisdom to be futile in that the wise and the fool would both be forgotten to history together. We remember Solomon to this day, but we know the names of almost no one else in his generation. Not even 0.1% of them, I'm sure. And even when we know their names, we know practically nothing of how wise or foolish they were. So if their good deeds are forgotten after they die, what did they really accomplish? For this, Solomon, who had put such a high value on wisdom and the benefits it brings, found wisdom to be ultimately useless, and he hated life for that. Just vanity and striving after the wind. Maybe if hedonism, that is, the unbridled satisfaction of one's pleasures, and the acquisition of great knowledge were meaningless, Solomon could find some meaning in his work. Things came to Solomon easily. He was born into unimaginable wealth. Maybe what he needed was a challenge to get the things he wanted. Maybe he needed a goal to work toward to keep him occupied. But then, occupying the mind to keep it distracted from the ultimate reality is just another facade. Whatever work he might be doing, work must serve some end, the creation or acquisition of something, and whatever thing Solomon was working toward, it would be pointless. If he worked to better himself, it wouldn't matter. He and his skills and his knowledge would die. And whatever things he produced, whatever wealth he stored, it would go to someone else, or rot and decay. Solomon would have value to the world in that he worked to make good things. The wealth he acquired would be valuable as a result. But then he would die, and all of his wealth would go to someone who is, perhaps, not valuable. So some fool would eat up all the value that his work had accomplished, spending it on things which Solomon would not have valued, using it to shape the world in a way that Solomon would not have wanted. So what would Solomon gain? Nothing. In the end, he would be working toward his goals and then leaving his wealth to people who would work against his goals. The work itself would undermine the work. It was just pointless. And yet, here were his subjects and all of mankind endlessly toiling and striving and suffering in misery, never having enough rest because there was always work to do, ultimately, all for nothing. And so, from chapter 2, 24 through 3, 15, we have Solomon's general conclusion on this matter. Seeing that there's nothing we can do that gives life meaning, what do we do about it? Now note that in the midst of this section, at chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, we have an extended poetic section demonstrating the meaninglessness of everything. We'll get to that in a minute. Solomon's general advice, though, written in both 2:24 and 3:12 through 13, is to eat, drink, and take pleasure in all our toil. That, of course, is the passage from which we derive the old saying, "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die." The idea is that whether or not our pleasure will give our lives meaning, it is essentially all that we have. Long life is not guaranteed, and no matter how long life is, eventually it ends. Solomon's advice, then, is that we should try to at least enjoy ourselves along the way. Solomon tells us that good circumstances, if we are fortunate enough to have them, are from God. They are his gift, a gift which we could not have if he didn't give it to us. And so we should graciously accept and enjoy God's gift. Solomon also tells us that bad circumstances are from God. He says that those who displease God have a miserable lot in life, working only to gather up things to give to those in whom God has pleasure. Skipping ahead to chapter 3, verses 9 through 11, we understand that it is true that mankind will toil, and it is true that our toil will be meaningless, but along the way, God will give us beautiful things as well. God endures forever, and he has given us a mind to understand his eternality. We long for that immortality, but at least, from Solomon's limited perspective, there's no way we can have it. We long for that immortality, but at least from Solomon's limited perspective, there's no way we can have it. The world is as it is. What has been will be again. Nothing we can do will really change that. So what do we do? Enjoy the ride. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. But then, we have a caveat to consider. The words "eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die" could be taken to encourage a hedonistic lifestyle, a lifestyle of focusing solely on pleasuring oneself. Obviously, such a lifestyle would have to be moderated. We should enjoy ourselves, but not to the point of excess. Personal pleasure is excessive when it becomes sinful. Obviously, there are many sins which would be pleasurable, at least momentarily, but we should restrain our quest for personal pleasure so as not to violate the command of God. We should enjoy pleasure as God's gift, not steal pleasure against his will. Later biblical authors made reference to the idea of eating, drinking, and dying. Isaiah mentioned this in Isaiah 22:13 as a response of the people to a great calamity in a day of mourning, for example. However, more relevant to the topic at hand, Jesus mentioned this also in Luke 12:19. There he told the parable of a rich man who stored up his wealth and then selfishly used his wealth only for his own pleasure. "Eat, drink, be merry," said the man. God responded by saying that the man would die that very night, presumably for his selfishness, and leave his goods to another. The man valued his own pleasure over the general well-being. He had struck the wrong balance, and Jesus spoke against that. In this case, it was not, "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die," so much as, "Eat, drink, and be merry, and as a result, we will die." Clearly, pleasure is good, but not in excess. In applying this portion of Solomon's writing, we must remember that he spoke from a perspective which had no knowledge of eternal life. Paul also cited "eat, drink, and be merry" in 1 Corinthians 15:32, making clear that the philosophy is defunct from an eternal perspective. There, Paul said, "What do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Paul's point is that he was willing to die for his faith. He was willing to be thrown to the wild beasts, as many other Christians were killed around that time. But if there is no resurrection from the dead and eternal life, then what would be the point in that? How would the Christian worldview be worth dying for? Clearly, it wouldn't be. If this life is all we have, then arguably nothing is worth dying for, because at death, all is lost. In that case, a hedonistic philosophy of self-pleasure really is the philosophy that matters. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. But Paul cautioned us that this is not the way to live. He said that bad company ruins good morals and cautioned his readers to wake up from their drunken stupor and turn from their sins, turning from the philosophy of self-pleasure to a focus on the eternal perspective. And that perspective is a very different perspective. In that perspective, the faith is worth dying for. Without a path to eternal life, this life is everything there is. But compared to eternity, this life is nothing. Paul was no fool to sacrifice worldly pleasures and indeed to sacrifice his life itself to have a better eternal reward. So while you're here, try to enjoy the ride, but also don't lose your focus on eternity. Having discussed the primary thrust of the passage, let us turn back for a moment to chapter 3, 1 through 8, in which Solomon describes in poetic form that there is a time for everything under the sun. The general point here is that everything is ultimately meaningless because everything comes and goes in cycles. This is essentially another reiteration of the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. Herein, Solomon lists off 14 things and their opposites, saying that there is a time for each of them. Of course, the things neutralize each other. As there is a time to be born, he begins, so there is a time to die. The death neutralizes the birth, making the birth a pointless endeavor. And so it goes for the remaining things. There is a time to plant and a time to pluck up the planted things, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and to laugh, to mourn and to dance, etc. Some of those that are more interesting on the list are as follows. Solomon mentions that there is a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. That one doesn't translate particularly well to modern culture. In ancient times, important events were often memorialized by gathering together a pile of stones as a memorial. Examples of that can be found in Genesis 31:46 or Joshua 8:29. Solomon's point, then, is that there is a time to memorialize an event, but also a time to forget. Two of these I find interesting because of their violent connotations. We are told that there is a time for war and a time for peace, a time to kill and a time to heal. That would oppose a totally pacifist philosophy. What is the time to kill? The time for war? The answer, as with all things, is that the laws of God should be our guide. The time to kill or to go to war is when the law of God justifies killing and warring. So keep that also within a moral context. Maybe a bit harder to reconcile is the first half of verse 8, that there is a time to love and a time to hate. When is the time to hate? Isn't God love? That's what 1 John 4:8 says. And we are told to love our neighbors as ourselves, to love even our enemies. When is it good to hate? To answer this, I did a little search of the New Testament on the word hate, and I came up with some interesting results. As it turns out, the old adage, love the sinner, hate the sin, while it is not itself a Bible verse, pretty well sums up my findings. For example, 1 John 2 tells us that whomever hates his brother walks in darkness. So don't hate your Christian brother. However, you should hate wickedness. Hebrews 1:9 says, "You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions." In Revelation 2:6, there is praise for the church at Ephesus for hating the works of the Nicolaitans, hating their sin, but not the sinners. This hatred of sin leads to a hatred and rejection of the things of this world. In Luke 16:13, Jesus said that we can't have two masters, but must necessarily love one and hate the other. And in Luke 14:26, he gave the only positive example of hating a human that I can find. There Jesus said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." In that, Jesus' intent was not so much that we should hate people as that we must be prepared to sacrifice everything, even those things most dear to us, to be Jesus' followers. So this again is an example of loving Jesus and having a relative hatred of the world. The point then is this: there is a time to hate. The thing to hate is sin, and in hating sin, we should focus ourselves on eternal life, even if it costs us everything here. In that regard, this life compared to eternal life is what we should hate. And indeed, Solomon did say he hated this temporal life, as he mentioned in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 17. To conclude, in Ecclesiastes 2, 1 through 3, 15, Solomon outlined his arguments demonstrating the meaninglessness of life and his response to it. Solomon told of how he sought out purpose in life by giving himself to his work, by growing in knowledge, and by giving every pleasure to himself. No matter what he did, he found it all to be meaningless in the face of his impending death. His response to this was to take a moderate approach toward enjoying life. He accepted the reality that his circumstances came from God, and he tried to be grateful to God in enjoying them. In comparing this to the fuller revelation of the New Testament, we found that Solomon's temporal perspective was lacking in eternal context. We do have hope of eternal life. For that, Paul said that the eat, drink, and be merry philosophy was lacking. Paul was prepared to sacrifice the pleasures of this life to gain a better eternity. Jesus also was critical of unrestrained self-indulgence. So let us enjoy this life, but be cautious to prepare for the next and to care for our community as we do so.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.